Production support for Earth Eats comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at GriffeyCreek.studio. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
If we have a conversation about healthy foods and they don't involve conversations about capitalism, then I'm just not interested in them anymore.
Today's show features an interview with Marcia Chatelain. She's been researching the role that Black-owned fast food franchises have historically played in Black communities. And Eric Shedler has that falafel recipe we promised you last week. You can tuck it into those spelt flour pita pockets. You remember those? That's all just ahead, so stay tuned. First, we'll start with Alex Chambers. He's got a couple of news items. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Kate. It's looking like the EPA is close to making it harder for states to regulate pesticides. And there's a new bean in town that's not new at all. Earlier this month, the Environmental Protection Agency made an announcement that could mean it will overrule states that want to limit pesticide use. The release said the EPA would be reevaluating its approach to state requests for pesticide restrictions. State regulators are worried that could make it harder for states to limit pesticide use. Currently, the EPA receives about 300 requests each year to use pesticides beyond what is officially allowed for that product. However, some requests are to narrow the federal label. That can mean adding more restrictive cutoff dates or limiting the number of treatments allowed. The agency said it was evaluating the circumstances under which it will exercise its authority to disapprove those requests. The change would have a direct effect on pesticides like dicamba, which several states have moved to restrict after drift caused damage to neighboring crops. Any changes ahead would not apply to the upcoming growing season. The EPA plans to put any changes up for public comment before making a decision. Alongside meat-heavy food trends like the keto and paleo diets, one bean in particular has been getting steadily more popular in the U.S. That's right, chickpeas are on the rise. Monthly Google searches for chickpeas have tripled since 2011. You can now buy roasted chickpea snacks, chickpea chips, and dessert hummus. There are a few reasons they're getting so popular, according to an article by Amanda Mull in The Atlantic. While the proportion of vegans and vegetarians is holding steady, red meat consumption has dropped by one-fifth. Chickpeas are also high in protein. They tend to trigger fewer allergic reactions than wheat or soy, and they're immensely versatile. They're good for the planet, too. They add nitrogen to the soil, and they're drought-tolerant, which means they should hold up well as the climate changes. In their new embrace of chickpeas, Americans are not on the forefront of the food world. Chickpeas have been part of the daily diet for people around the world for millennia. Americans are finally, it seems, catching up. Thanks to Chad Bouchard for his story.
Thanks for that, Alex Chambers.
Sure thing, Kate.
And speaking of chickpeas, did you know you can make your own falafel with chickpeas? And it doesn't require hours and hours of cooking beans on the stove. You don't even have to break out your pressure cooker. Falafel is a vegetarian dish with origins in the Middle East. Israelis and Palestinians have been arguing over who gets to claim falafel as their own, but the spicy fried bean nuggets most likely originated in Egypt. They're sometimes made with fava beans, but chickpeas are also common. Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery shares how he makes falafel with chickpeas that have been soaked overnight.
So we're going to make some falafel to eat with our spelt pitas, and we're going to do it all in this food processor. It's really simple, classic recipe. So I need half of an onion and a few cloves of garlic. I'm gonna chop them up in there. And then you use soaked but not cooked chickpeas. Just gonna chop it into a few pieces before I put it in the food processor. Like to smash your garlic when you peel it. Throw the garlic in.
How many cloves of garlic did you put in there?
4. Whenever a recipe says 2 to 4, I'm always at 4 or 5. All right, now we're going to put in the parsley and cilantro that we got in the greenhouse. Probably more than a recipe would call for, but you can never put too many fresh herbs in your cooking.
When you have a greenhouse on site like they do out at Muddy Fork, you can have fresh herbs year-round.
All right, we're going to chop up those herbs, onions, and garlic before we add the chickpeas. I smell the cilantro. Mm-hmm. So this is 1/2 pound of chickpeas, 1/2 pound dry, and then soaked overnight. All right, got 1/2 the chickpeas in there because my food processor can't hold them all. Should look about the texture of bulgur when it's chopped enough. All right, put this in a bowl and then process the other 1/2 of the chickpeas.
Oh, it smells incredible.
Mix the 2 batches together. I'm gonna taste a little bit of it, even though it's got not cooked beans in it, because I soaked the beans in salt water and I don't know if it has enough salt. I think it needs a little more. I put my other teaspoon of cumin in too. Then after mixing, you're supposed to let the falafel mix chill for a while. I think it's supposed to make it easier to form balls that will hold together. Mm-hmm. Okay.
After the mixture has had a chance to rest, form it into balls or small discs about 1 inch or 2 around.
So whenever you're going to fry, you want to be prepared. You have a place where the finished food is going to go. In this case, it's a plate with some paper towel on it. You have your oil with a thermometer in it so that you get it to the right temperature, which is usually between, for most foods, between 350 and 375. And a slotted spoon for taking things in and out of the oil. And here we go. We're gonna roll a few balls and throw them in. Try to squeeze it together so it holds. There we go. Temperature dropped a lot. Manage your pot of oil. You gotta keep adjusting the flame.
Those are perfect.
The falafel is done when it's golden brown all around. Remove them with the slotted spoon and place them on a paper towel to drain. Each batch only takes a couple of minutes to cook, and surprisingly, they absorb very little oil. Walking us through the steps was Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery. Falafel is the ideal filling for his spelt pita bread, which he shared with us last week. You can find the recipe for the falafel and the pita at eartheats.org. For those involved in the good food, real food, and local food movements, it's easy to write off fast food, either because it's not good for you, it's not good for the environment, or because the industry doesn't pay its workers a living wage. Or if you happen to be well off, maybe it's just not classy enough for you. But through the second half of the 20th century, African American communities and even civil rights organizations saw fast food franchising as a way to bring jobs and money into Black communities. It's hard to imagine today that a McDonald's franchise could ever be seen as an engine of Black socialism. But Marcia Chatlin, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, reminds us that African American communities continue to be constrained, and fast food has been one way to make things work. Dr. Chatlin's first book is called Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration. She's currently finishing up a book about the relationship between Black communities and the fast food industry called From Sit-In to Drive-Thru. EarthEats Associate Producer Alex Chambers spoke with her via Skype.
Your first book was about the Chicago end of the Great Migration through the lens of Black girls. Was there some sort of progression that took you from that to this?
You know, the kind of bridge I often talk about in terms of my two projects is that after I finished up in graduate school and I was traveling between Chicago and Oklahoma City, where I first started teaching, and then Washington, D.C., I would spend a lot of time in my hometown of Chicago. And I always thought it was really fascinating the number of cultural institutions or various activities that I encountered that were underwritten by the local chapter of the National Black McDonald's Operators Association. And I remember in high school, the first time I ever read anything about the Great Migration was part of a history quiz bowl TV show that I was on through my school. And I remember that it was the McDonald's operators that had paid for the prizes for the competition. And so it always was this kind of issue in the back of my head in terms of what does it mean for an organization of Black franchise operators to not only have kind of so many footprints in a city, but what does it mean for the relationship between communities of color and fast food when there are these franchise owners who are kind of like local heroes or ambassadors or well-known entities.
I never thought about the fact that the rise of fast food happened right at the same time as the civil rights movement was sort of taking off.
Right. So one of the things I talk about in the book, the first chapter looks at doing a critical race history of fast food and thinking about fast food and the housing market as being very similar, where there's some of the politics of redlining, there's the federal infrastructure that's allowing a lot of whites who are either leaving the military and using the GI Bill for business loans or who are entering franchising and they're able to be successful. So franchising kind of grows up in the suburbs and becomes very popular in terms of highway transportation, right? And all of these structures are so bound by racial constructs of where funding is allocated and where it's not, who has access to houses in the suburbs and cars to drive along the interstates. And then there's this massive shift in the 1960s after 1968, where there are all of these uprisings after the assassination of Martin Luther King. There are various hot summers. And one of the most consistent refrains, or rather responses, to uprisings is that poor communities need their own businesses. African Americans really should buy into some of the Black capitalism rhetoric that reemerges in this time, and this is going to be the way forward, business. And the business that is kind of ready to pounce is the franchise industry. When gas prices started to soar, and when more and more suburban families were being discerning about how they spent money or whether they would want to fill up the car and expend gas to go to a fast food restaurant, the fast food industry really saw the inner city as the place to grow because it was a larger consumer base that walked to stores. And they also knew that putting in Black franchise owners would ingratiate them to the community. And one of the things that I think is really important to note when we were talking about these things is that, you know, I don't think anyone at that moment could anticipate the size and the consequences of the fast food industry when they're trying to bring it into communities in the 1960s and 70s. But by the 1980s, it becomes very clear that there's some very complicated consequences as a result of this, but this relationship is at that point 20 years old. And so you have this kind of brokering between major civil rights organizations, federal subsidies, and then a fast food industry that is just trying to gain as much ground as possible.
Can you talk about those consequences that were unforeseen, that it was really, I think, are starting to become clear more, you're saying, in the 80s?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's interesting. When I'm looking at the early conversations about fast food, some of the critiques of the mainstream fast food industry is that, okay, you know, we really need to have our own Black-owned franchises. And so there's these attempts to create these companies that are considered authentically Black franchises. And they're not able to compete with the wealth and the size of some of these other major ones, like your McDonald's, your Kentucky Fried Chicken, your Burger King. But initially, the critique or the resistance to fast food was, will this really provide all of the things that it's promising our community in terms of wealth and investment opportunities? And if it's not, then we have to build our own fast food. But there wasn't a real kind of concern about it. This idea of a McJob that is low wage, you don't have the right to organize, that it's really physically taxing, that doesn't kind of enter the conversation again until the 80s. And so the critiques that we have today of the fast food industry, they are slow to develop. And I think part of the reasons why some of those critiques aren't leveraged is because people actually think it's not a bad idea, that it could actually be a legitimate source of economic development and renewal, because the industry in many ways was still growing as well.
So I'm curious, was there a complicated conversation going on around, well, okay, we've got these McDonald's available to us as a way of sparking the economic engine of the community, but it's still, you know, it's a franchise. It's owned by a corporation.
So in the early days of franchising, the post-1954 franchising moment that characterizes a lot of McDonald's growth and its leadership under Ray Kroc, you knew who your franchise owner was because they were actually required to work in the store. So there was a way that there was a real kind of personalization of the experience of going to a McDonald's or going to a Burger King or going to a Taco Bell that fades as the industry goes. But initially, people actually, they didn't leverage those kinds of critiques about kind of corporate power, because there were many ways in which a franchise could still feel very familiar and connected to the community, if that makes sense, right? Like, there are some questions about, is our money going out of our community? But then there was also the sense that if we go to a Black-owned McDonald's, we're still able to support our community in some ways, because a large part of the culture of franchising in local communities in these early days was about philanthropy and a lot of being very present, you know, donating Little League uniforms and doing the college scholarships. And the African-American franchise owners, I think, were particularly attuned to their kind of sense of responsibility and how people in the community would view them in terms of the resources that they could bring. So, you know, some of this corporate critique emerges, but not in the kind of robust ways that you would think in light of some of the other critiques that are being made about capitalism and systems. There's this anecdote in my book about how in April of 1969, Ralph Abernathy, who takes over Martin Luther King at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he goes on kind of a national tour to commemorate the first anniversary of King's death. And he stops a few weeks before his tour, he gives the speech and he says, "We don't need Black capitalism, we need Black socialism." And, you know, everyone's like, "What's going on here?" And so shortly after he gives the speech, he shows up at this McDonald's in Chicago and he picks up a check from a Black franchise owner. And we could say that that act is, like, you know, rife with all sorts of contradictions and questions. But I think in that particular world, there is a way that the economic possibilities of African Americans are so constrained that they have to kind of fit to get some very basic needs met. So there is no kind of, there's no tension in the fact that, you know, Abernathy is calling for socialism and then his organization is very excited about franchise possibilities. And so I think that, you know, I write about critiques, but a lot of the critiques are about the extent to which McDonald's, particularly, because it's the first one that's doing what they called minority franchising, the critique is to the extent that they're going to be a citizen, not even like a question about their citizenship in inner city America.
What do you mean by the critique is that they're going to be a citizen? That it's about how involved the McDonald's is,
yes,
going to be in the community.
Not if they should be here. It's like, well, how are you going to fit yourself into the things that this community needs and be part of it? There's another anecdote about Portland McDonald's, Portland, Oregon, and the local Black Panther Party is accused of bombing them. And one of the reasons that they are allegedly a target is because they won't donate to the breakfast program and they won't be a member of the community in a sense that, like, this is what you're supposed to do. If you're going to be here and if you're going to profit from us, there's got to be some exchange. And a lot of the strategy that the fast food industry has to figure out is, how much do you concede to these demands? How much do you give in to these boycotts? Because they know that they're going to grow and they know that the inner city is incredibly profitable and this is a market they want to be in, but they also are very concerned about setting precedent. And so there's these different situations in which these protests, these boycotts of their stores emerge, and the boycotts are about the terms in which they are going to engage the community. Rarely are the protests about getting them actually out of the community.
Right, right. And to a certain degree, those protests do make a difference, right? I mean, it seems like there is an effort by McDonald's to start to invest at a certain point in Black ownership.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the thing. It's kind of the question of what's the goal? If the goal is more franchise owners, yeah, you can get more franchise owners. If the goal is to make sure that the franchisee is contributing, absolutely, you can get that. You know, I think that a lot of McDonald's success is predicated on this idea of knowing kind of when to get involved and when to step back and let franchise owners take the temperature of communities and figure out their relationships. But a lot of the philanthropy that is associated with McDonald's, the Ronald McDonald houses, and all of these different efforts, a lot of these are done by franchise owners and not necessarily the corporation. And there's a reason for that. I think they learned very quickly that franchising works because basically someone else carries the water or takes on all the liability of your company for you. And part of what I chronicle in the book is that in the 60s and 70s, there are liabilities, quote unquote, of doing business in the inner city. There's the demands of the community, there are the expectations, and there's also some real structural issues in terms of the higher cost of doing businesses in communities that are poorer. And so all of those like issues, they are on the shoulder of the franchisee. And so a lot of what I talk about is this way that even within a system that allows for some African Americans to become wildly wealthy and to have a lot of influence and power, there are still these questions about equity and fairness, even within this system, because African Americans are ultimately constrained, whether they're constrained in terms of their consumer choices or they're constrained when they're doing business. These are the constraints that everyone is trying to negotiate and maximize. And I think that if there's a takeaway from my research, it's that, you know, what do people do with constrained choices? They make it work.
We've been listening to Alex Chambers interviewing Marcia Chatelain. After a quick break, we'll hear about her own relationship with fast food and her thoughts on the fight for 15. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers. Featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Marcia Chatelain is an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University. Let's return to Alex Chambers' interview with Dr. Chatelain.
Did this, working on this, did this change your own relationship to fast food?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up eating tons of fast food, and it's that kind of thing that's so interesting. You know, I don't eat as much of it now because I'm just older and my digestive systems don't work like they used to, but I will never say that I'm an anti-fast food person. I have concerns about some of the health consequences, and I have concerns about the working conditions. But I'm also, I think, increasingly just more sympathetic to the fact that the choices that people have are the choices they have, and that's fine. And I think I was maybe a little bit more compelled by some of the kind of conversations in the healthy food movement. But if we have a conversation about healthy foods and they don't involve conversations about capitalism, then I'm just not interested in them anymore. And I think it's kind of changed the ways that I think about how we solve problems around health and nutrition. And it was important for me to write a book about the fast food industry that wasn't about food, but about all of the other things that happens.
So did this lead you to any new thoughts about sort of current issues like the fight for 15, anything like that?
I think that in terms of labor and thinking about the concentration of fast food in certain communities and what a job means in some communities and what a job means in others, it just makes me think about all of the things, all of the arguments and all of the affective work of fast food writing itself within a civil rights context, and how that can be a very effective tool in resisting the demands of workers. I think about that a lot. Like, you know, I was talking to a franchise owner, and I visited one of his restaurants, and his manager says to me, you know, I'm one of the few people who is going to employ someone with a criminal record. And I give people a second chance, and people saying, this is like my ministry. We can write that off and say, okay, this person's just saying this, whatever. But I think that some people really do mean this, and some people really do see the jobs that they provide as doing something really powerful. I think the problem is that for people who are in that orientation, we have to help them understand what justice really looks like. And so it's this thing I often say to my students, like, we always think that advertising works on everyone but us because we're smarter than the advertising. But when we think about how this industry has created wealth that then helps pay for historically black colleges and universities to have scholarships, and then provides opportunities for sports, and then says, like, if you just keep on working at this industry, maybe one day you'll make it like I will. Like, even in my most cynical moments, I get how people are really moved by that. And the question is, for those of us who have a different vision of justice and opportunity, what are we going to provide that is as compelling and as effective so that people will believe us when we say that another world is possible?
That was Marcia Chatelain, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. Look for Marcia Chatelain's book on this topic in early 2020. It's called From Sit-In to Drive-Through: Fast Food and Black America in an Age of Crisis. That does it for our show this week. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Renee Reed, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Marcia Chatelain, Eric Shedler, and everyone at Muddy Fork Bakery. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at griffeycreek.studio. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers, offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.